Welcome to the Storage Stories Podcast, where Deanie Burns and Jason Coonan tackle self-storage news, trends, education, and share their expert experience in both the U.S. and Canadian markets. This podcast is for rookies and seasoned veterans alike as we all try to grow our businesses and leave our mark on the self-storage industry.
Hey everyone, welcome to Storage Stories. I'm Deanie Burns. I'm with Jason Coonan, our CEO of Sunbird Storage, and we are the Birds. In each episode, we will be addressing breaking news in self-storage, including mergers, acquisitions, industry consolidation, interest rates, the U.S. economy, emerging technologies, corporate responsibility, and international self-storage topics. We will also be hosting special guests like we have today. The goal is to educate and bring awareness, giving you the information that you need to compete with the major players in the industry. So kicking it off, we're going to be talking about breaking news today. So in today, recently there's an article that came out that was really good about the three self-storage signals to watch for this summer. So street rates versus in-place rates. Street rates are dropping, as we all know. So this makes it more difficult to do underwriting. Rate volatility in active lenders. Demand trends. The final piece of the puzzle, it says, will be ultimately in how the economy functions and what has become a strategic cooling period. So excellent article. The next piece of breaking news is, of course, the Sorbel acquisition of Storage Auctions. So how that is going to play out, how customers feel about that has yet to be seen. But that was a really interesting new development. And then also one that actually involves us was Williams Development has kicked off their development of their Clemens self-storage facility in North Carolina. We're really excited for them. They're a great group. They're movers and shakers, and we are super excited to get to partner with them. So that is some breaking news in self-storage today. All right. So Jason, would you like to introduce our guest today?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Deanie. There's certainly a lot going on in the industry today. And we're fortunate to have our friend James McLean joining us today from Radius Plus. We've seen James at all of the conferences, and we follow him closely on social media. He's always covering the latest trends in self-storage, business intelligence. He's got all the best data and covering all the pricing trends in the market. So James has a very strong background in urban planning, and he seems to be the go-to expert when it comes to self-storage data and pricing. So James, can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in self-storage, some of the work that you and the Radius Plus team do, and a little bit more about your background for our listeners that may not have had the good fortune of meeting you yet?
So I kind of stumbled upon, thank you, number one, for having me on the podcast. I'm super excited to do this. You guys are awesome. I also have been following you closely on LinkedIn, Jason. Love the content you put out. So I stumbled upon self-storage like almost arbitrarily. A buddy of mine I went to college with had been working at Radius for a couple months, and he brought me on board on sort of the ground level. And then 1 week after I started, COVID hit, and the rest is history. So, you know, I came at a very weird inflection point in the industry where things just took off, and I didn't know what normal was. But it kind of initiated me to want to learn more about the space and just dig into the weeds. So I think at its core, Radius Plus does supply and demand analysis for the self-storage space by tracking all active facilities, new opens, pricing trends. But it's really a tool that's meant to help anyone in the industry, you know, from the top operators to newbies, people who are starting out who can make educated decisions whether they want to build or buy a location.
Yeah, no, that's great, James. Certainly, Radius Plus is the authority on supply and demand, which is really how we make all of our decisions, right, in terms of new development projects, potential acquisitions, pricing our units. It's coincidental to me that it sounds like you and I both got started around the same time. I know that the first project that I did in self-storage began the day after we had the lockdown and the pandemic started. So you and I seem to have mostly an experience through the pandemic and now post-pandemic, but we're not industry veterans in the sense that we have any pre-pandemic experience. So we'll have to rely on Dini to share more experience with us, but, you know, before we enter the industry. You know, in addition to sharing your background and kind of some of the data that you've certainly mastered, what are you hearing in the market today? How are things in commercial real estate and self-storage in general, you know, here midway through 2024? How would you characterize, you know, where we are now versus maybe where the industry was when you first started and what's happened over the last couple of years?
That's an awesome segue. I think that the main theme here is a bit of confusion. So like you mentioned, like COVID turned things upside down for the industry, and it hasn't quite been clear if it's gone back to what like previous patterns look like. Like you mentioned before, the demand portion is very difficult to gauge. While in-place rates are increasing over time, teaser rates have fallen tremendously from the previous years. And that's not necessarily surprising as demand's cooling off from COVID drivers, things of that nature, but it's been so much harder for people who have followed a playbook or been in the industry to make decisions that historically made sense to them. Like asking rates are no longer the best indicator for demand. You'll see a facility that stabilized pricing well below market just to continue to drive top of the funnel and keep their occupancy high. So it's been really confusing for a lot of industry veterans as well as new people entering the space to make sense out of the data that's publicly available. So with that in mind, commercial real estate in general is having a hard time. Like office space is leaving unoccupied. So self-storage as a whole is still proving to be resilient, but with high interest rates, it's difficult to develop or even acquire, as there's a big gap between like seller expectations and what kind of capital a buyer can come up with. So it's confusing and interesting to say the least.
Yeah, no, for sure. It seems like there's been sort of a regime shift. As we moved through the pandemic, we had this big surge in activity. Occupancy was going up. Price, operators were able to really command any price they wanted. And now as things start to slow down, there's been a seismic shift in the way that operators are using, you know, web rates versus in-store rates, teaser rates, ECRIs. I think we should dive into that a little bit later in the program. What are you seeing, Dini, in terms of some of the impacts that are hitting self-storage? We know that the housing market is closely related, but what trends are you seeing and how's that affecting the large and small operators?
What I'm seeing is there's actually a slowdown, obviously, people moving because people had locked into the low interest rates back in 2020, 2021, 3% and 4%, 30-year fixed. And so they don't want to give that up. And so if they were to sell their house and then go and buy another house, then now they're at a higher interest rate. So there's lack of supply. People are not moving. And this, our industry, self-storage, is reliant upon people transitioning and moving around. So when they move, they tend to rent some self-storage wherever they're moving to, put their furniture there for a bit. And that really helps our industry. So I was recently on a podcast where they said that consultants are averaging that it's the lack of movement is impacting our industry 6% plus. So that's a pretty big dip that we're seeing in terms of lack of demand due to lack of transition and movement of residential owners. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The housing market, we're certainly hoping will pick up as we head into next year, but it's been definitely a challenging time with mortgage affordability. So James, I know that you have a pretty rich data set. There's other pricing services in the market as well that cover, you know, large and small operators alike. Can you characterize the kind of price declines you've seen from the prior year and how that may vary between large operators and maybe smaller operators or large cities versus smaller cities? I mean, I get the impression that the declines in street rates are much more dramatic for large operators in large cities. Is that fair, or how would you characterize it?
Jason, you nailed it. And I just want to spin off what Dini said about the housing market. So if you're at this kind of like perfect storm where there's a lot of new supply that got added because of COVID, people were building, they're coming online now. So this influx of new opens combined with the fact, in primary markets, by the way, combined with the fact that there's a softening of demand. So people are fighting a lot more intensely to get these people into their facility. So this increased supply combined with the softening demand, they're lowering asking rates to the bottom in these primary markets where these new opens happen. Now, this isn't quite the case in tertiary areas or operators are a little bit more, maybe mom and pop, let's say, or smaller operators. So the pricing volatility is most intense in these primary areas, like densely populated urban centers, where ECRI model comes into play a lot more effectively. The next portion to that is the intangibles, right? So if you're in like a smaller market, people know each other, and a bad review can really kill your facility's reputation. Now, this might not be as amplified in a big city where there's just so many people. So even if someone has like a bad experience or maybe gets rubbed the wrong way with a heavy ECRI, it doesn't necessarily kill the facility's ability to lease up because there's just so many people coming in and out of the market.
So, hey, James, let me stop you for one quick second there. So, for some listeners, they may not be as familiar with some of these techniques and acronyms. So can you elaborate a little bit more? What is an ECRI and how does it come into play and how has that changed over the past couple of years?
So one of the, I guess, fundamentals of self-storage is month-to-month leases. It's the ability for an operator or owner to raise rates on someone renting from your facility 1 month to another. You don't need to like sign a new lease. It's not like you're locked in for a year in most cases. So an ECRI stands for existing customer rate increase. So I like to make the distinction between a promo rate and an ECRI because a promo rate, at least you're seeing, it is written down. It's explicit. I call it an explicit promo. Whereas sometimes there's no, let's say, direction or indication that you're going to be raised aggressively or when. So that transparency to me matters. I think there's a big distinction between a promo rate and an ECRI. So an ECRI has been applied a lot more aggressively in the past 8 to 12 months in primary markets that are, like I mentioned before, fighting a lot more competitively to fill up their facilities. And then so, get them in a lower rate and then raise them over time more aggressively.
Right. So a promo rate, an example, might be the unit, the standard rate on the unit or street rate would be $100, but they've got a promotion going on where you can get 50% off your first month. So you know that you're going to pay $50 and then in 30 days, you're going to be paying $100. With some of the teaser rates, you might see a typical $100 unit now is listed for, $35. But what you don't know is that because there's no promotion, that $35 may go to $100 in as little as 90 days. So you think you're getting a $35 price. The contract legally is for a month. But there's ethical questions about once somebody moves all their stuff in, what types of rate increases and frequency they're going to get subsequently.
Yeah, exactly. It's just no way to plan for it because it's not up to you. It's like the operator can apply whatever they want to. And you're not held hostage. You can move out. But I mean, moving in and out of a self-storage unit is a logistical nightmare. It's probably like top 10 worst experiences you can go through. And that's part of the why, this industry is so sticky. People don't move out. They end up just keeping the unit. But, being raised over time with no predictability and how that affects your budgeting or anything like that can be difficult. Or, comes into question, like you said, are we doing, right by my renter or is this how I want to run my business?
And for a lot of folks in self-storage, a lot of customers, they may be first-time users of self-storage, second-time users. So they're unsuspecting, right? They see a price of, $40 a month and they feel like, oh, wow, this seems like a great value. They don't really know exactly what's happening until about 60 days later when they get that note in the mail. And now they need to find a new storage unit or they need to accept, a 1 or 200% increase, maybe find a moving truck or a moving company. So, the cost of switching can be quite high, which is why some of the large operators could take advantage of that, knowing that 70% of the customers are going to probably stay and take the first increase. So James, let's go back a second to some of the discussions you had about when you first got into self-storage and the pandemic was just beginning in 2020. How would you characterize where we are today versus where the industry was, pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, and now post-pandemic from more like an occupancy and a pricing standpoint? I know you're a bit of a data historian.
Well, I always say, a picture's worth 1,000 words. So if you just give me a second here, I'll pull up a graph. Oh, can you just enable my sharing ability, Dini? And then I'll be able to share my screen here.
Absolutely.
It's interesting to see this from a visual perspective because we're just about back to where we would have before in regards to occupancy and things like that. All right. Okay. Can you guys see my screen okay?
Yep.
All right. So this is a national occupancy. So it's like weighted for all the REITs, earnings calls, reportings based on how many facilities they actually have. So this 90.3% occupancy from Q1 2024, if we go back to like Q1 2020 or Q1 2019, we're just about around the same levels of occupancy with asking rates ironically being around the same level as well. But what we know from the earnings calls, the revenue is increasing because the in-place rates are higher than it was in 2019. So in a way, we're getting back to normalcy in these top 25 markets. That's what this study is done from. But the ECRIs have effectively driven the revenue of these facilities higher than it was in the past. So we're seeing normal levels of occupancy, normal levels of teaser rates, asking rates, street rates, whatever you want to call it. But then the actual renters paying more than they have in the past because they're being raised over time.
Yeah, so my expectation is as much and as swiftly as those asking rates have fallen, I think, it's just a matter of time, right, as they cycle through their tenants where the higher paying tenants move out and they're moving people in at much lower rates. Unless they can dramatically increase the average length of stay, I expect significant declines in industry revenue. It's just, the blue line will, I guess it's occupancy, but the in-place rents will over time, start to get dragged down to the street rates.
Well, yeah, that's the big question mark, right, Jason, is how effectively can you raise someone over time in a 12-month period? I'm going to go off on a tangent. So it takes 3 years for a facility to stabilize. Like that's kind of the industry standard, right? What, 36 months from the reach that 85%, 90 occupancy or whatever it is. But at that level of occupancy, are you still getting the price per square foot you need for your facility to financially stabilize? And I don't know the answer to that.
So the facility will certainly stabilize from a physical occupancy perspective with this strategy long before economic occupancy, right?
Got it. And so that brings up question marks in securing financing, right? Is your construction loan, should it be for a longer term? If you're using a different model, do you need to have a longer timeline to stabilize financially? So a lot of things I've taken for granted in this industry are just some question marks around it in my mind. Because this is almost like a new strategy. It's unproven. We're coming off a black swan event. I just don't know what the next steps are, what the results will show us in the next couple months.
So some of these new pricing strategies, if you will, right, the very aggressive teaser rates, the very aggressive ECRIs, those are somewhat new, call it within the last year. So the effects of them have yet to fully be realized, right? So you have the cycling through of half the tenant base, and then some of the larger operators who are publicly traded. We started to see a little bit of weakness, in my opinion, from the Q1 earnings, where it looks like revenue was starting to turn over. And I think as we move through this year, it'll be interesting to keep track of those earnings and see what the impacts of this new pricing regime are having on profitability.
100%. And there's some gaps in the data in the sense that this is only coming from the REITs who sort of have a bigger foothold in primary markets. And I'd be curious to see what similar statistics from operators who sort of dominate tertiary areas where, ECRIs are less prevalent, right? Maybe smaller markets where people don't take to the fact that getting raised over time, it leaves a bad taste in their mouth. Because anecdotally, when I'm surfing on rates, which is 50 hours a week, I see markets where there's pockets of strength. Where in a 2-year span, rates are only increasing because these operators are pricing true to demand. Facilities are filling up, demand is higher. And I see those numbers just ticking up. So I would imagine revenue is going the right way too. So as an institutional asset class in these primary markets, the data is available. But in my mind, there's a lot of opportunity in these smaller communities that are growing as people are getting priced out of cities and migrating to these more tertiary areas.
I just wanted to jump in with a quick comment here. So I think it's really interesting. We're talking a lot about the data and analytics, which I love data. But, I'm just sitting here thinking about what about the impact on the tenant with the ECRIs? Because recently I moved and it was a nightmare trying to get a truck. I won't mention the company that I rented from, but it was very challenging to engage with them and then to find friends to help move and, or, you know, hire a company to help move some of my items. So how we talked about, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking I'm on a budget. What if I was renting a unit and these ECRIs start happening and now my budget is completely skewed and blown out of the water and I have to start cutting in other areas because I wasn't anticipating this rate increase. You know, that's why I appreciate with my home, like the 30-year fixed versus the adjustable rate mortgage, because you know what your budget's going to be. So here these ECRIs start happening, people's budget is completely skewed. Now they are forced with having to rent a truck and having that negative experience in their past and going, oh my gosh, now I have to go through this again is frustrating. Now I have to find friends to help me move potentially or hire somebody. So the ECRIs are really a big deal. There's a huge impact on the people. And I would just think personally that would cause a lot of frustration for me with the vendor, the self-storage operator, to constantly have that. And so, you know, I think we could dive more into the psychology of it later. But the other comment that I wanted to make was your chart was very informative to me because it really reinforced what the feds are saying in terms of inflation. So I was talking to one of my friends in the real estate industry and I go, I don't know where they're coming up with this inflation because I mean, we're seeing kind of deflation, decreasing prices in our industry, but as you charted it over time from 2018, 2019 to now, that there actually has been inflation. So that really was eye-opening to me. So right, great part. Right.
An important thing to keep in mind too, Deanie, is $1.23 or whatever the price per square foot is for the asking rate in 2019 does not carry the same purchasing power now. And so that's why the ECRI model has to drive the store's revenue. And I think you're right. I don't know if the full effects on the psychology of it has been realized yet. But one thing that I keep hearing from top operators is there has to be more investment into your staff, into the training your facility managers and these intangibles that maybe not show up on paper, but make a big difference in your renter's experience. You know, make sure they walk the store. They're knowledgeable in all the units, and they take care of the renter. I think that there's a big push for hybrid and remote, but so long as you know, the customer experience isn't altered or decreased, then it's okay. But you have to really prioritize it.
Yeah, good point.
For the fact that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really good point. Yep, I was, like I said, on the industry podcast yesterday where they were saying the same thing about investing in facility staff, in training and people, which is making a huge difference in the value add versus the unmanned model. The weaknesses of that model are coming to the surface and being realized. And so operators are starting to take a look and go, I'm not sure that was the best strategy. So that's interesting how that's playing out. So I wanted to ask you, James and Jason, so how do lower prices on spaces impact the value of self-storage facilities in the long term?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Like if your facility's not stabilized yet from a price per square foot perspective, it's still leasing up, I would imagine the valuation of the location is lower than what it could be, right? If you're getting people in and like the real value of the unit. Although, Jason, you probably want to speak more to this, or?
Yeah, I would say I think we should dive deeper, Deanie, on this topic in a future episode. We should bring on a experienced appraiser to find out how they're treating these pricing strategies. You've got a case where many of the facilities are now, instead of historically, right, you would charge more for your units than most customers were paying. And over time, you would bring the rent up in the facility towards the gross potential. Now, the gross potential is lower based on the street rates than the in-place rents. So the achieved rents are actually falling. So the question is, what assumptions and how does an appraiser use this kind of data in a market that's, you know, undergone some type of seismic shift? So I think it'd be really good to hear from, you know, one or, you know, even more than one appraisers about how they're treating the different pricing strategies and what they're actually assuming, right? It's really hard. You know, if your in-place tenants are paying $20 a square foot per year, but you've got teaser rates at $10, you know, what do you actually use to value the facility? But certainly, in my opinion, lower prices, which lead to lower NOI, which lead to lower property values, are definitely not good for owners and investors.
Well, I'll take it a step further. So when you do have that episode, I'm definitely going to tune into it, because we've been hearing so many crazy stories about like tax reassessments, you know, after an acquisition, or even for developments where, a county will assess your facility from like the top of the line, right? Like a stabilized facility who's just crushing it, and your new guy is leasing up. You know, you're forced to do teaser rates if you're in a market where that's what your competitors are doing, but you're reassessed at such a high value, you're just getting killed by property taxes. So it's like, how are, you know, county tax assessors reacting or trying to get educated or getting informed, let's say, on this new pricing strategy to work with these owners so they're not just underwater during the lease-up period? There's a shift has happened so recently that there's such a lag time in how people are reacting to it or how they can respond, you know, treat everyone fairly.
That's a good point about the taxes. I didn't consider that, but that is a really valid point.
Because it takes a really long time for your facility to get to the value that the county might think it's valued at.
Right.
So I also wanted to ask you too. So our facilities how is it going out there in terms of our facilities selling? Is the market frozen? You know, how are you feeling about the asking prices? Are they within range? Because I know people had been complaining about, or buyers had been complaining that the sellers were looking to get too high of a price and that they weren't within range of where it should be. So have you seen that adjust to reasonable levels, the pricing of facilities, and then how is that impacting the sale of facilities?
Oh yeah. I mean, succinctly, transaction volumes down like 25% from like 2018, 2019, 2021, 2022 is like fantasy land, right? You have a bunch of consolidation in industry. So those numbers look insane. But the biggest thing is it's a seller's market, and these guys' heads are in the clouds where they still have the valuation of their facility of where it was at, you know, during COVID. And they say, yeah, you know, you could raise rates to market level, but it takes time. And people may not pay what they paid in 2022 for a unit now. The demand might not be there. So transactions have been very difficult. I know brokers are working overtime to make this happen. And they're working with both the buyer and the seller to make it a possibility that it can actually happen, especially since the cost of capital is so high. So maybe if you're someone who's loaded with cash, you can really crush it in this time period. But for most people, it is super difficult to make a deal pencil for development as well as acquisitions.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of acquisitions, you know, James, you covered a lot of great points, but it's a really difficult combination, right, for buyers. So you've got sellers who are maybe have, you know, irrational price expectations at the same time as their street rates have fallen dramatically. And then the cost of borrowing is, you know, super high, right, compared to what it was. So all those things make deals really hard to come to agreement on and to come with the right value. So that's impacting active transaction levels, of course, which, you know, closely related, of course, to the acquisitions. Deanie and James, what are you hearing and seeing for new projects, for developments?
There's an equal amount of challenges. Cost of construction is very high. The steel prices and things like that. But we are seeing developers make some breakthroughs through conversions. You know, distressed commercial real estate, like an old big box store, like a Kroger or Publix or something like that, or even a mall that's out of business. They're converting those to self-storage. And it's almost twofold, because they can save some money on the construction. If the roof is good and the ceiling height, it works with a self-storage facility. But also, you get way less pushback from the township, because you're taking advantage of like a brown site that's not being used for anything. And you're bringing in an asset that actually serves the community, that helps solve people's problems. So I'm a huge fan of conversions. You know, it kind of harkens back to my urban planning background. Makes me happy to see developers do something positive for the community, as well as renovate a space that's not being utilized currently.
Yeah, that's great. How about you, Deanie? I mean, we hear from developers all the time, right? Some that are thinking about building, some that have properties that are now coming off construction. It's definitely been very, very challenging due to, you know, elevated construction costs, operating costs, labor. What are you hearing, Dini? What's the market like now for development?
Yep, challenging. Absolutely. You know, steel prices are high. It's difficult to get things like electrical panels and different pieces of the puzzle that are definitely needed. And then also getting the permits, getting the legislative bodies to sign in and approve the project. So they're worried about oversupply and they're, you know, they just have concerns. And so it's very important to be involved in the local government and supportive of it. And explaining to them the value of what you're going to bring to the table in terms of the community. And so I think we're going to touch upon in another episode, social responsibility, which is very helpful to getting those projects passed by the local government and to get those permits. But a lot of challenges with development as well. So a lot of barriers to entry and then also just getting insurance for those facilities, especially in California, has been a real struggle. And so insurance companies are, you know, they, with all the climate change and the wild weather, that's also been a struggle. So a lot of challenges for developers, but those who are, have been in it for a while, I know our development arm, great, ran by some great people, have been in the industry for a long time. So that's where you really want to lean on people with experience who can help you navigate through those challenges a lot easier than somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. That can cause a lot of delays and add in additional costs to a project. So it's really important to engage with somebody who has been in the industry for a while and can help you navigate these hurdles and pivot and you know what they're doing. And I agree with James in terms of conversions. Conversions are very popular right now. And like you, James, I'm really excited to see buildings repurposed. I mean, no one likes to see an empty building all boarded up in their town. It just sends the wrong message. So I'm really glad that self-storage operators, owners, and developers are taking advantage of those and doing something good with them. So that's really good to hear.
Yeah, Dini, I would just add before we move on that we have come across a lot of, you know, inexperienced developers, and in some cases they're being hit, you know, on both ends because, number one, because of their lack of experience, they ended up probably paying nearly twice as much per square foot to build their facility. So they built it at the worst time, right? They started planning it at the beginning of the pandemic. They got entitlements, and now the project is almost ready to be birthed into a market where you have dramatically lower street rates, which they don't know any better. So they're trying to match those. So you have the most expensive construction costs ever and the lowest street rates. So there's a lot of developers that are in trouble, and that's why hundreds of projects over the last couple of years have been scrapped. Hundreds more on pause, and people are really not sure what to do. A lot to figure out, certainly, with the new pricing regime in the market.
So just a positive spin on that, though. If you are able to make your deal pencil, you're primed to be in a really good spot. Because like you mentioned, Jason, so many projects are being canceled. So we're on track to see a real slowdown of supply growth across the country. So for those of you guys who are still able to really, you know, tough it out, find a deal, make a pencil, do the hard work, you might be in a really good spot, because the demand drivers for self-storage are pretty constant. It's more so how much supply is added to your market that could really impact your facility's performance. So, you know, stay positive, and, you know, people who are putting in the hard work will see the results from it.
Yeah, there'll certainly be some benefits to those that are brave enough to keep going right through the slow time, because you know, a year or two from now there'll be better supply demand balance.
100%.
Yeah, thank you, James, for adding in the positive and giving us some hope for the future. And I completely agree with you. I mean, I've seen both the commercial real estate industry and the residential real estate industry, and those who are willing to tough it out and look at the glass half full instead of half empty. Those resilient, hardy ones are usually the ones who profit the most when there's an upswing. The pendulum always swings back. And so it's just important to have grit, perseverance, diligence, and push through. But it's also important to get educated as well. So if you do go into it, I heard someone at a conference say that post-pandemic, or actually through the pandemic, COVID, anybody could open a facility and make money at it. It was super easy. And that's no longer the case, right? You have to have experience. You have to know what you're doing. You have to look at the numbers, read the data and analytics, and make informed decisions and be more precise in your decisions and correct. And so there's no longer the pandemic market where, there was just cash flooding in, and there's not that wild ride, that wild high, sort of the roaring 20-ish, prosperity-ish. That's no longer. Now it's more pragmatic and more about doing due diligence and doing things right. And so anyways, with all that said, does anyone else have anything they want to add to this topic, this discussion?
No, I think we covered it pretty well. I think we need to come back and talk more about valuation on future podcast.
Agreed. Yep, absolutely. And social responsibility, that will be a great one as well. So James, I really appreciate you, just your energy and you being out there at trade shows and interviewing people. I really enjoy your interviews. They're always insightful and you make people feel comfortable when you speak to them. I really just enjoy every time we get to interact and appreciate all that you're doing in Radius Plus. I know I've used the program and it's very easy to use, very user-friendly, very robust, rich in data. We're really enjoying it. Really grateful for you and Radius Plus. So thank you for being out there. And just one last question, just for fun. People want to get to know you. So is there anything that you want to share with us in terms of hobbies or just like, who is James McLean? Like anything personal you can share with us?
Sure. So when I'm not doing self-storage things or reading about the industry, I am an absolute beach junkie. I love being by the ocean. I'm from Hawaii originally. That's where I was born. So I try to go back once a year at least. And I love being at the water. I love swimming, being at the beach, getting in the sun. So that's something that I'm really excited about. The summer's entering it. So can't wait for some weekends out there. That's something about me.
Nice. Now, are you a surfer?
No, I'm not a surfer though. I tried once, but I still have yet to pick that one. I'm more of a to splash around, ride the waves. So there's that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a tough sport for sure. I took a couple lessons myself and yep, it was not for me, but it was, but I fell a lot. That was fun. Yep.
I have a much more respect for those who do surf. So I'll just cheer them on from the beach.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds great. That's fun. Well, thank you for your time today. Thank you for all that you do for our industry. Very informative. The graph was great. Really appreciated that. And so we're going to get all of your contact information, share it out on our socials and in our show notes as well. So you can know how to contact James and get in touch with him if you would like a demo of the Radius Plus software and all that it offers. Or do you call it software or database?
Yeah, software is a platform is like the best term, I guess, we use.
There you go. So awesome. Well, thank you for tuning in to Storage Stories today. Please hit the subscribe button, like us on YouTube and follow us. We really appreciate any comments. We want to hear your feedback to hear more about the shows that and topics that you want to hear about. So all of our contact information is going to be in the show notes along with our website, www.sunbirdstorage.com. And again, we would love to hear your comments, your feedback, and thank you for tuning in today.
That concludes this episode of the Storage Stories podcast. Be sure to share and subscribe as we continue to tackle self-storage news, trends, education, and personal experiences from the competitive world of self-storage.